Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming. It's great, great to see you all. Let's see, is this one on? I think it is. Okay. So today is not really a typical Sunday because you've come while we're on retreat. There are, I think, about 18 of us that are on retreat here today. So I'm going to explain a little bit about what that means in case you haven't been here on a Sunday during a retreat before. Here at Zen Center, we have a retreat every month, and they range in length from a half a day up to 7 days. Some of these are traditional retreats, where we have quite a lot of ritual in our tradition, the Japanese Soto Zen tradition, where the priests here wear robes, and we eat in a formal style. And then we also have contemporary retreats, which are less formal, but quite rigorous also. This is a contemporary retreat, and it's 5 days long. So we started Friday evening, and we'll be going through Wednesday until about 4 o'clock. And retreats are a bit challenging, they're a bit difficult, and they're just great. And perhaps sometime you can join us. And retreats are conducted in silence. Very little talking. Well, there are Dharma talks, and we talk in one-on-one meetings between teacher and student, but otherwise very little talking, just enough to maybe convey what your job is for work period or something like that. And so today, since we've been in silence for quite a long time, we need to maintain our focus. And that's why after the lecture today, there won't be any tea and conversation as there usually is. But please come back next week and we'll have tea and conversation and we can all get to know each other better. And before I go further, I'd just like to thank a few of the people who are making this retreat possible, some of our officers. We have our retreat coordinator, known as the Eno, and that's Wanda. Where's Wanda? On the stairs. She's on the stairs. She took the last seat that was left in the house. And we have our cook, that's known as Atenzo, that's Kate. And we have our work leader, who for some reason doesn't get a Japanese title. I don't know why that is. And that's Mark. Where's Mark? He's waving from back there. So thanks, you guys. Thanks for all your hard work, and thanks, everyone, for your hard work. So during this 5-day retreat, I'm giving 4 talks, and I'm focusing on the life of the Buddha. Since this is the time of year when Buddha's birthday is generally celebrated, I think the most common date for celebrating it is April 8th, and today is, I think, the 13th? Is today the 13th? So yesterday, I talked about stories. I talked about how stories, like the story of the life of the Buddha, can really help us because they reflect our inner journey. We each have an inner journey. We have changes that go on deep inside of us that may happen just like that, kind of an emotional change, a change of the way we view the world or something. But they're so mysterious that we can't really put words to them. We can't really analyze them. They're beyond words. But stories, I think, can give these kinds of things expression. And I think stories also can give us great encouragement about how others have managed to deal with difficulties. So I began the story yesterday by talking about the awakening of the Buddha's aspiration before he was the Buddha, when he was still Siddhartha, and I focused on 2 stories. The first one was when he was 9 years old, he had a vivid experience of life and death of small creatures during a plowing festival. He saw worms and birds and things who were being killed by other creatures, and it had a deep impact on him, and he felt rather ill, and he sat under the shade of a rose apple tree where he began to feel better, and then, unbidden, through no effort of his own, suddenly this great sense of ease and joy came over him, something like he had never felt before. And the second story I told is a very well-known story about how the Buddha went forth from the palace where he was a prince who had been kind of protected from the harms of the world, had led a sheltered life, and he encountered suffering on a trip outside of the palace. And he became very upset by that, very sad, and he resolved to do something about it. He wondered if there might be a way for humans to avoid suffering. So he had a great aspiration. And I also talked about how everyone here has an aspiration of some kind that brought them here. And how aspiration often begins with a focus on relieving one's own suffering, and that when one really sort of pursues this aspiration, it tends to broaden out and become an aspiration to save all beings, to save others. And this just happens. You don't have to worry about it too much. You simply do the practice. You pay attention to the moment. That's our practice, to be here right now. We do this through meditation. We do this through mindfulness. We do this through a million different things. But that is just the practice, just coming back, not being distracted, not being in thoughts of yesterday, thoughts of the future, thoughts of how this should be different from what it is now. It's rather, what is it now? What is it now? We can keep asking ourselves that. So I'd like to continue with the story about what happened after the Buddha's aspiration was fully awakened. He made a decision to leave the palace and to become a wandering monk. He was going to find the truth. And in India, by the way, this is a little historical background, at that time, that kind of life as a wandering, begging monk was regarded as a rather normal thing. It was a way of trying to find the fundamental truths of human existence. And people had already been doing this for about 4 or 5 centuries, in 2,500 years ago. So it started about 3,000 years ago. And it was believed that there were 4 periods of a person's life, studenthood, and then family life, and then life in the forest, seeking the truth, and then finally wandering. But the difference with Siddhartha was that he left rather early compared to others. Most people waited until their children were grown, and then they would go off and do this. And Siddhartha decided to do this while his child was still small, and I think he was about 29 years old, which is a little troubling, but that's a subject for another talk. So he left the palace, and he left with his charioteer named Chana, the same guy that had been with him when he had gone forth from the palace and discovered what suffering is like. And he got to the edge of a forest, and he cut off all of his hair. He took off all of his jewelry and ornamentation. He gave them to Chana, and he said, take these back with you. So cutting the hair was a sign of renunciation. And people had been doing it here and there. But after this, Buddhists began to do that a lot. There's this just odd story of something that happened. He was at the edge of the forest, and Chana was driving away in the chariot, and he is about to enter the forest and begin his new life. And just as he's about to do this, this man comes walking out of the forest, and Siddhartha sees he's wearing monk's raiment. But then he also sees he has a bow and a quiver of arrows. And that doesn't seem right. Monks don't hunt. And he says, are you a hunter? And the man says, that is correct. And Siddhartha asks, if you are a hunter, why are you dressed as a monk? And the guy smiles and he says, well, I'm dressed as a monk so that the animals will trust me and it's easier to shoot them. Oh. So Siddhartha says, then you are abusing the compassion of those who follow a spiritual path. Would you agree to trade your robe for my garments? And the guy says, do you really want to trade? And Siddhartha says, yeah, these are worth a lot of money. These are worth so much money that you can sell them and you can abandon your life as a hunter and find some other line of work. And the guy says, okay, I'll do it. And he takes off because he doesn't want Siddhartha to change his mind. So that's a pretty good story. Not only did Siddhartha get monk's clothing, he also saved many, many animals in the process. So Eventually, Siddhartha found his way to two teachers, one after the other. One was named Alara Kalama, the other was Udaka Ramaputta. Both were masters of yogic meditation, and they were the leading masters of their day, I think, or two of the leading masters of their day in that part of the country. And he learned everything they had to teach him. And if I remember correctly, both of those teachers asked him to stay and lead their groups because they recognized that Siddhartha had learned everything that they knew and perhaps even surpassed them. But he knew that he had further to go. He was not satisfied yet. He had not solved the problem of human suffering. So he began this period of austerities, entering into austerities. He did this, most people say 6 years, it may have been 10 years, we don't really know. But at that time, there were austerities of four times that were practiced, according to Ikeda, Daisaku Ikeda. One was control of the mind, which is bringing the mind under total control. So just no thoughts whatsoever, just stopping thought. Suspension of breathing was another. This is not recommended nowadays, at least I don't recommend it. Fasting for long periods. You may have seen statues of the Buddha, the fasting Buddha, where you can see every one of his ribs and he's just incredibly thin. And the last one was severe dieting, which would be not stopping food completely, but severely restricting the amount of food that you take in. And I was kind of surprised to read that at that time there was this detailed set of rules for doing these things, and people followed them in strict obedience. It wasn't just done sort of haphazardly. So what was the point of such austerities? We know that, you know, fasting, people do fasting these days sometimes, and it can help with spiritual attainments, I think. But why go to these huge extremes? Ikeda says, the body was believed to be defiled, while the spirit was basically pure. And it was therefore only after one had subjected the flesh to mortification that the spirit could attain the kind of peace that represented final emancipation. So it was believed you couldn't hope to reach the ultimate truth unless you engaged in these kind of austerities, almost killing off the body, or killing off your attachment to the body. And I think we can say that this is based on a dualistic view, that ego is identified with the body, ego is evil, and it has to be destroyed. And in Soto Zen, we view this quite differently. It's true that we are trying to find some quiet, where the ego and the chattering mind that comes with the ego quiets down, becomes calm, and a kind of a death of the ego can occur in kind of a small way or a large way. But it always comes back. And our practice then is not about being free of ego. It's not about destroying the ego. It's not like St. George and the dragon. It's about having a new relationship to the ego and to the self and to the grasping mind. This is all still present. It arises and falls. But it's probably not running the show quite so much. There's something else, something bigger running the show. So people around Siddhartha were astonished at the extent to which he took these austerities. He went really far, and at one point they thought he had died. And he pursued it for all those years, and he got nowhere. And he was no closer to his goal of relieving human suffering, no matter what he did to himself. And at one point he cried out, surely there must be another way to enlightenment. So during this period of his life, he was accompanied by five other ascetics. So there was this group of six guys doing this all together. But at one point, after doing this for years, he found himself practicing alone one evening. And it had been a hot day, and he had been sitting in a graveyard all day, probably, you know, contemplating death, sitting in a graveyard, and it had been a very hot day, and as the sun began to go down and the evening came, a gentle breeze came up, and it made him feel good. And I can understand that. I mean, what can feel better if you've been working out in the hot sun all day and it's been perfectly still and you're sweating and you're really struggling, and all of a sudden this gentle breeze comes up. I mean, what can be more wonderful than that? It's like a drink of water when you've been deprived of water for a long time. It's worth more than $1 million, right? It's just one of the basic pleasures of life. And at that moment, when this breeze came over him, he remembered the cool shade of that rose apple tree that he had been sitting under when he was 9 years old. And this period of quiet joy had come over him. And Karen Armstrong, in her book Buddha, recounts this story in a very beautiful way. And she says that, okay, when he's sitting in the graveyard, he's emaciated, he's exhausted, he's dangerously ill. And he remembers the cool shade of the rose apple tree. And he realizes sometime after the rose apple tree incident that he had attained the first jhana, which is, at the time, there were these sort of levels of yogic meditation you could attain. And he had attained the first one as a 9-year-old child. And many yogis, after years of study and hard work, only get to that first jhana. And he had gotten to it without any effort on his part whatsoever. So he had shunned all happiness as part of his campaign against his desire. He had almost destroyed his body. Yet, as a child, he had attained that yogic ecstasy without any trouble at all, after an experience of pure joy. And he began to think of himself as a convalescent who had had a fever for years and was just recovering. And think of that. Think of that great pleasure if you've been sick and you're on the mend and you're feeling better now and you can go outside. What a wonderful feeling that is. What a great joy in life that is. And he was struck by this idea. Could this possibly be the way to enlightenment? Could joy be the way to enlightenment as opposed to austerities? If an untrained child can reach the first jhana and have intimations of nirvana without even trying, then yogic insight must be profoundly natural to human beings. He'd been fighting his nature and crushing every impulse. He had come to distrust any kind of pleasure. Now he realizes, why be afraid of the kind of joy he had experienced as a child? Because that is not a grasping kind of joy. That's not a joy connected with ego. That's not a kind of joy that we have to be suspicious of because it's all about us trying to take things from our environment. That's sort of this deep joy of ease and relaxation and being in the world. It's not about grasping at the world. It's about being in the world, just simply being part of it. And it's all okay. That's not grasping, and we're all in this together, every one of us. I'm not even doing this on my own. It's not even me. It's all of us. So, another way to put this, this is from a book called Old Path, White Clouds, is that, just checking, he realized that body and mind formed one reality that could not be separated. The peace and comfort of the body were directly related to the peace and comfort of the mind. To abuse the body was to abuse the mind. And out of this came the middle way, or sometimes it's called the middle path. Don't give yourself up to pleasure and hedonism on the one hand, and don't give yourself up to great austerities and asceticism on the other hand. Find the path in the middle. So what did he do after realizing this in the graveyard? He got a good night's sleep. He'd probably been depriving himself of sleep. And the next day, he bathed himself in the river. It's kind of a purification, and I think he was really grungy. And when he tried to get out of the river, his strength failed him. He could not get out of the river. So he kind of rested in the water for a while, and eventually he grabbed a branch of a tree and pulled himself out. And he started walking, and he collapsed. And a girl came along. Her name was Sujata, and she gave him some milk or some porridge of some kind, and his strength came back a little bit, and he began to eat solid food again. And he hooked up with the five guys again, and they were disgusted. It's like, you can just imagine them muttering under their breath, "Oh, Siddhartha, he's a sellout. He's eating solid food. We are done. We are done with him." So the Buddha was not yet enlightened. That would come later. But he had discovered the middle way. And you could say that his real path toward enlightenment was just beginning after this horrible years-long detour of practicing austerities. So after his enlightenment, he enjoyed the pure bliss for a while. He wasn't sure whether to teach or not. He didn't know whether people would be able to understand what he had done. So I'm moving a little ahead here toward, after his enlightenment. But he decided to teach, and he went and he found those same five guys. And they saw him coming, and they're like, "Oh, there's that Siddhartha again, you know." But then they watched him a little more closely, and they saw that he had kind of an ease, kind of a wonderful bearing. He was kind of radiant. They said, "Well, maybe we should listen to what he has to say. And besides, he's a guest. We're not going to send him away." So he sits down, and he talks to them, and he delivers his first sermon, known as the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, or Setting in Motion the Wheel of Truth Sutra. And that's the one, there's an excerpt from it on your program. And that's the one where he talks about the Four Noble Truths, which is just, you know, very, very basic in Buddhism. But he also talks about the middle path. And he says, "There are two extremes in this world, O bhikkhus, O monks, which the religious wanderer should avoid. What are these two? The pursuit of desires and indulgence in sensual pleasure, which is base, low, depraved, ignoble, and unprofitable. And the pursuit after hardship and self-torture, which is base, low, depraved, ignoble, and unprofitable. There is a middle way, O bhikkhus, discovered by the Tathagata," that's him, the Buddha, "which avoids these two extremes. It brings clear vision and insight, it makes for wisdom, and leads to tranquility, awakening, enlightenment, and nirvana." So now the big question, I always like to bring this back to us because these teachings are so alive today still. What is the middle way for us in practice? What is the middle way for us? In a sense, the middle way is much easier than practicing austerities. We don't have to starve ourselves. We don't have to do all those horrible things to ourselves. But in a sense, the middle way is difficult too. In a sense, it's even more difficult than the austerities. And that is because if you follow the middle way, you have to take responsibility for figuring out what the middle way is. And it's always changing. And there's nothing to hang on to. And it's a constant adjustment to what is it now. Which is different from coming up with a simple rule for yourself, right? If you say, "Well, I'm going to sign up for this extreme. I'm going to engage in austerities, and I have this detailed program from ancient India, and I'm going to follow all of these, and I'm going to become enlightened that way." Then you don't have to figure out minute by minute or breath by breath what to do. You just follow the program. But to follow the middle way, you need the wisdom to know what that way is right now. It's constantly changing, and you have to be constantly alert. And there are no easy answers. And Stephen Batchelor talks a little bit about the uncertainty of the middle path. "In a shifting, contingent, and unpredictable world, the practice of such a middle path is a juggling act. There are no guarantees that having found it, one will not lose it again. As a way of life, a middle path is an ongoing task of responsiveness and risk. Grounded on a groundless ground, it twists and turns. Its twists and turns are as turbulent and unpredictable as life itself." Sounds scary, right? We want something more solid we can hang on to. But this is the nature. This is the nature of how things are. And it's okay. It's okay. Once we let go of our thought that it has to be something predictable that we can sign on to so we can be secure, once we let go of that, it's so much easier because you're not fighting reality. You're sticking with it. You're okay. It's like the next thing is okay. This thing is okay. How do you find this middle path? Do you have to wait until you stumble across it? Do you need to join a religious organization? Is it revealed to you in a moment of mystical rapture? Or do you force yourself onto it by an immense act of will? Now, if you know me at all, it probably won't surprise you if I say I don't think forcing yourself on it by an immense act of will is the way to go. So what is the best way? I'd like to explore that a little bit. What is your middle way with respect to meditation practice? The best explanation I've seen of this is from Pema Chodron, who is a great writer in the Tibetan tradition, in a book called The Wisdom of No Escape, called Not Too Tight, Not Too Loose. And I've referred to this before, and I'm sure some of you have heard about this before from me, but it's so helpful to me, and I'm hoping it'll be helpful to you as well. And I think it's a good thing to come back to today for those of us who are in retreat. I think maybe the timing is good, and it certainly can't hurt any of us to get this practical advice about meditation. So I used to notice this pattern when I would go on retreats. Didn't always happen, but I would tend to go in with a lot of expectations. I would want to try really hard in order to fulfill my expectations. I'd get kind of tough with myself, kind of militant. I would resolve to do everything perfectly throughout the entire retreat. And I would totally exhaust myself after a while. And I would end up pretty much giving up. And sometimes after giving up, I would come back to the moment, and it seemed like the giving up was an essential part of the process, and that was fine. Other times, I would just kind of be stuck there in the giving up. Depended on how long the retreat was. Two-day retreats were not so good because, well, anyway, we don't need to go there. And when I read this chapter, I saw that she talked about that very thing, about how we engage in those cycles. And not too tight, not too loose is about finding one's balance in life, as she says. That's the same as finding your middle way. And, of course, her middle way and your middle way will be different. She says that her style is casual and laid back, so strict practice is really good for her. Maybe you're a person who tends to be really militant, really hard on yourself, and maybe a more relaxed practice is just what you need some of the time. Now, you might ask, this is me talking again, not Pema, how could it ever be that relaxed practice is best? Don't we need to make a constant effort? Don't we need to make a continuous effort? Shouldn't we do this without ever letting down our guard? Well, no, I think that doesn't always work. And I think ultimately in practice, we have to be soft and open. Ultimately in practice, we have to let things be. And if we're always grinding away at this thing, you know, it's like we're trying to take something from life rather than giving, you know. And we have to let it in. We have to let it in, and that means ease. And militancy can help to prepare you. It can help you to get your focus. It can help you to get things quiet. But ultimately, you let it go. I'm thinking of two statues over at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts. They have such a wonderful collection of Buddhist sculpture and paintings and things over there, and I go there a lot. And there's this one sculpture of a Zen master, and he's in a glass case, and he's sitting kind of like I'm sitting, and he's about full size, and he is the sternest looking person I've ever seen in my life. Does this ring a bell for anyone? Yeah, you've seen him? He's so thin you can see his ribs. The corners of his mouth are drawn down just as far as they can possibly go. His posture is really rigid, and he's holding something. He looks like he's about ready to whack you with this thing. And I would never actually study with someone that fierce, but I recognize him as a type. You know, he's an extreme. And they also, over there, have several figures of Kuan Yin, or canon, in the royal ease position. This is the Bodhisattva of Great Compassion, Avalokiteshvara, a kind of androgynous figure sitting there with one knee up in royal ease. Just relaxed and fitting in. Just relaxed and fitting in. And that's the other kind of extreme. I say, use the stern one when you need it, probably more in the beginning. Use the royal ease when you can, when you're ready for it. That might come upon you unbidden. After all of this practicing, after all this fierceness, you may find yourself relaxing. That's okay. So, back to Pema. She says it's common experience to take extreme views. And she describes just what I went through at my early retreats. She says, sometimes we're like a drill sergeant, and sometimes we're like mashed potatoes. And she encourages a little humor. A little gentle laughter at ourselves for being this way can help a lot. And a sense of joyful curiosity about the whole thing. Now, I said in my talk yesterday, it was my hope that we could keep things very simple. All we have to do is keep coming back to this breath, this moment, this activity. That's what we do on retreat. That's what we can do as we're leaving today, if we're not staying. As we're walking around the lake, come back to this breath, this moment, this activity. But what does that mean to simply come back? It's not always easy to know how to do that. Our conscious mind kind of gets involved, and we think about different approaches that might work. And what will work at one time may not work at another. As it turns out, there's a teaching for how to come back, and it's in that same chapter. These are 9 different ways of resting the mind, as set forth by Pema's teacher. They're all about finding balance, she says. Now, if you heard my talk yesterday, it may surprise you a bit, because yesterday I talked about keeping things simple, and I said, there are no assignments. All you have to do is come back to the moment. And now I'm giving you a list of 9 different practices to choose from. And what I have to say about that is, that was then, this is now. In a retreat, a day is a long time. Maybe things are different now. We needed that focus in the beginning, but maybe for some of us, things have gotten heavy and we need to lighten up a little bit. Maybe for some of us, things have gotten light and we need to get a little more heavy. I mean, it's up to you. That's the point. But these could be subtitled, I think, 9 ways to lighten up. These are Tibetan teachings, and they may seem quite a lot different from our style, but I think they can be useful. It's helpful to keep coming back to the breath. Sometimes we have this self-talk going on. And as long as it's going on, it might as well be something useful and helpful. So I'm going to go through these 9. And I just ask that you hold them lightly, that you not try to do all of them or try to real hard to remember them or try to analyze them too much or anything like that. Just hold them lightly. Maybe one of them you'll recognize as something you've done before and you might think, well, I could do that again. Or maybe something you've never thought of and you think, well, I could try that. But hold them lightly. So the first one is called Resting the Mind. I find that the titles don't always fit the practice. They don't always fit the way she describes them. Resting the mind means putting the main part of your attention on the breath as it goes out. So it's simply following the breath. But what's different here is she doesn't say put all of your attention on the breath as it goes out. She says put most of your attention on the breath. So the instruction is not to blot out thinking entirely and only concentrate on the breath. It's to kind of let other things in a little bit and put most of your concentration on the breath. You're concentrating on the breath, but maybe you're vaguely aware of the motorcycle, too, that you hear outside. And that's where the resting part of resting the mind comes in. If you find yourself too tight, this can be a bit of a softer focus to broaden what it is you're letting in. The second one is called continually resting the mind. And that is prolonging that sense of being with the breath, elongating that sense of feeling the breath as it goes out. So resting the mind is something you do. It's a way of paying attention to the breath, whereas continually resting the mind is more of an attitude, prolonging that sense, taking it with you, so that in each moment you're not distracted by this new thing. And maybe you take it with you off of your cushion, and when you're getting tea, you're still resting the mind. The third one is called naively resting. This is my favorite. Just come back. That's it. Just come back. No big deal. Just do it. Take a naive, childlike view. Come back. Forget all the self-talk. Just come back. Sometimes it works. Number four is called thoroughly resting. And you do this one when you are very settled, when your mind is very calm. And what it is, it's trying to catch each flicker of thought, the tiniest flicker of thought, just to kind of see that and be aware of it. You watch it arise, you watch it fall. You don't indulge in it, you don't encourage it to go further, you watch it rise and you watch it fall. And for those of you who are familiar with the idea of the five skandhas, this is about spending time in the third and fourth skandhas, where things arise in the mind, but they haven't yet turned into these big stories. So this is thoroughly resting. It's a quiet thing. You're just watching the stuff come up, and you're watching it go, and you're not chasing it. You're not needing anything. You're at the movie. It's the movie of things that haven't really happened yet. Number five is taming the mind. This is developing a non-aggressive attitude toward what occurs in your mind. It's about accepting whatever is happening in your meditation, whether that's could be persistent thought, could be a great sense of spaciousness, could be anything. It's about accepting what happens and being kind of friendly toward that. Number six is pacifying. This is a teaching with a lot of good humor in it. It recognizes that we all have times when we're discouraged. It's taking a very kind attitude toward ourselves and offering ourselves understanding and encouragement. We can get hard on ourselves when we're meditating, really hard on ourselves, and harder than we would be on any of our friends. Why is that? That we're harder on ourselves than we'd be on any of our friends. You take care of yourself. Like, yeah, there's the little man. He's discouraged. He needs stuff. But he's a sweet little guy. He's like he's a child. I'll just take care of this guy, you know? Seven is called thoroughly pacifying, and these are specific instructions about antidotes to specific difficult states of mind. One is aggression or anger. If you're caught by aggression or anger, emphasize the windy, airy, fresh quality of the breath as it goes out. This will connect you to spaciousness, and anger has a hard time thriving in spaciousness. Next, if you are caught by lust, it happens. The instruction, surprisingly, is to pay close attention to your body. Emphasize your posture, ground yourself in your body, do kind of a scan, how do I feel at this time? If you're drowsy, again, connect with a sense of spaciousness. If you need an antidote to a song going through your head, come see me. I have one. Number eight, one-pointedness. I don't know why it's called that. This is my second favorite. It may surprise you. If your practice is driving you crazy, just stop. Just stop practicing altogether for a while. Keep your posture so you don't get too loose, you know, and don't leave the zendo. But just let your mind go where it wants to go. Open your eyes wide for a while, and maybe you'll come back refreshed. I mean, it's going to happen to all of us, right? We're going to abandon our practice. Let's do it deliberately so we don't feel bad about it. Okay, I'm abandoning my practice for a while now. And number nine, the last one, is resting evenly. This recognizes that meditation is simply developing a thoroughly good friendship with oneself and accepting what comes along. And there's a verse that goes with this. As swans swim on the lake and vultures roam in the charnel ground, you can let your mind rest in its natural state. Whatever comes, the bad stuff, the good stuff, let your mind accept it. This sounds like shikantaza to me, which is a Soto Zen term. So there they are, and I ask that you just hold them lightly, and keep in mind this idea of finding your own middle path, and the constant challenge that it is, and the need for wisdom. And just stay open. Don't let anything become a thing. Everything wants to become a thing. Just, no, don't let that be a thing. Move on. There it is. No, that's not a thing either. So that's what I have to say. And if anyone has a comment or a question, I'd love to hear it. And if, yes? You know, I don't want to talk about it because it might encourage it to happen. And you don't want that happening on retreat, right? So I'll tell you later. Yes?
How do we deal with confusion?
With confusion? I think being present with confused mind rather than trying to resolve the confusion.
I'll remain confused.
You'll remain confused for a while. I would say experience the confusion and don't fight it and see what happens. Now, if you're talking about confusion about some sort of practical problem, like what should I do with you know, this next phase of my life or something like that, of course you do need to resolve that. But I think a good beginning is to just kind of sit with the dilemma. And there is conscious thought, which we pursue and is very important. You have to figure things out. We all do that. Everyone everywhere does that. In Zen, we also have this practice of just sitting, and maybe sometimes sort of holding the dilemma and seeing if something arises. And sometimes that can be very effective too. Okay. Anyone else? Yes?
I think you alluded to before you read the nine practices, mm-hmm. that there was a slight difference between that and Zen. Or did I miss?
Well, what I said was that these are Tibetan practices, and so they might seem unfamiliar to us. And this is—it's just a teaching that has come out of Tibetan Buddhism. I think Tibetan Buddhism—I don't like to generalize—but I think it probably has quite a few more techniques for meditation than we have. We tend to be without technique. If you come here to sit, we might point you to the wall and say, "Sit." And not give you very much meditation instruction. You know, that's an exaggeration. I mean, we'll talk about following your breathing. But in Zen, I guess we kind of take the approach that any kind of technique can turn into a thing that you get attached to. And you kind of forget that there's something beyond that. You know, the technique is not the answer. There's something beyond that. So it becomes a thing. Yeah. Thanks for the question. Okay. Anything else? Maybe one more question? And if not, that's okay. All right. Well, thank you so much.